We want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Healing Insight. Healing Insight is an acupuncture and holistic medicine clinic on Grand Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota. Owner Senya May and her team of practitioners can help patients with everything from anxiety to fatigue, digestive issues to women's health, and so much more. And we are living through such an uncertain time. Many of us are dealing with a level of stress and anxiety that we've just never seen before. And the team at Healing Insight is here to help. You know, stress takes its toll on our adrenals. And Senya can do a free phone consultation to see if virtual adrenal testing is right for you. Senya and her team are doing Facebook Live videos twice a week and personalized virtual appointments. So whether you're comfortable coming in person or want to connect virtually, Healing Insight wants you to know they're here to take care of you. I've personally been seeing Senya for several years. I'm now part of her membership program, which means I have a standing monthly appointment. Senya was also our featured guest on one of our most listened to episodes of Best to the Nest. It's episode 25, simply titled Anxiety, and in episode 113, where we talk about coping with the COVID-19 global pandemic. Go to healinginsightonline.com. That's healinginsightonline.com to find out more about Senya and her team. I'm Elizabeth Reese.
I'm Marjorie Punnett.
And this is Best to the Nest, the podcast that is all about creating strong, comfortable, beautiful nests that prepare us to fly. And today we're talking about one of my favorite topics in all of the land, Marjorie. It's farming.
Yes! I'm very excited about this because I want you to know, Elizabeth, I am a strawberry farmer.
Oh!
I harvested. I am doing the way that I farm is one strawberry at a time.
That's not going to make you very much money. I can tell you that. It's not going to keep the lights on.
So I have harvested one strawberry a week. And then I had one stolen by either a squirrel or some sort of varmint. It was the most beautiful, luscious, big strawberry. And I got greedy, Elizabeth. I got greedy. I had built a little twig nest around it to protect it, which my sons said that was stupid, but it had worked. It was a beautiful little nest. It was a little house around this beautiful strawberry. And I thought, oh, just one more day and it'll be perfectly red. And I came out the next morning, all of it gone.
All of it gone.
It bit it off at the stem, took it away. I mean, it had to have carried it away with both hands. It was so big.
Listen, before you know it, you're going to be sitting out there with a pellet gun and you're just going to be watching for whoever gets into your garden. Listen, don't you think Jay has not gotten out in the backyard with a slingshot that he bought in cash so no one could track it to try to hunt down a raccoon that was threatening our chickens? You can bet your bippy he's done that.
It was quite traumatic, honestly. It really was. I felt like it was almost like losing a pet. I had been nurturing that strawberry so tenderly. And then to have it just disappear and not know where it went was very traumatic. And it gave me a whole new appreciation for farmers and attachment
Listen,
to the land.
I know. And you know, I mean, I say this all the time. I say it on television every time I can. I say it on the radio all the time. I say nobody works harder than a farmer. You will
Amen.
Not find a single person working harder than a farmer in this country or in any other country. And that is just the truth of the matter. And if we don't have farms, we don't have food. And
right.
I think we've been talking a lot about food and where it comes from and our connection to it, particularly during the COVID-19 crisis, when I think there is a segment of the population that became acutely aware that we really take for granted the fact that we just go to the grocery store and get stuff. Because when you went to the grocery store, there was no stuff, Marjorie.
Right.
And it felt very scary for a lot of people. And so what I think is really cool about that is the opportunity to say, hey, let's take a little bit of a shift and let's actually know where our food comes from and have much more of a connection to where it comes from. Now, Marjorie, you're not going to make a profit on your strawberry crop, but we certainly hope that our farmers that we know and love are making a profit. And the key to that is having a relationship with the people that they sell their food to and having a market. And so we're talking to a farmer today. Isn't this great?
Which is wonderful because I think that that's really the key. And you know, I'm lucky enough that I live in Tempe, Arizona, and I know some of the farmers, because I've done stories on some of the farmers, and for people who are listening to this and they think, well, how the heck am I going to get to know my farmer? One, you're going to get to know one this morning. But two, farmers markets are such a great way to support local farms. Yeah, so I'm very excited about this.
It's so good. Okay, so our guest today is Karen Weiss from Littlefoot Farm in Afton, Minnesota. And I texted her this week and I said, two things. I need to order half a hog. And also, will you be on my podcast? And if you don't want to be on my podcast, that will not impact the sale of the half a hog.
Good.
I'm still buying the pork. So Karen and her family live and work on Littlefoot Farm in Afton, Minnesota. They raise heritage hogs, grass-fed beef and lamb, and then vegetables, herbs, and fruit. And it is truly, listen, I mean, I know it's easy to idealize life on the farm, and Karen doesn't make that plight any easier, because when you drive past the farm, you go, this is a magical place. The animals live outside, the family lives on site, and something is always growing there, even in the dead of a Minnesota winter. So today we're going to talk about why small farms like Karen's are so important. And then we're going to relate this back to our own nests, right? How can a relationship with where your food come from change the way you cook and eat in your home? So we're chatting with Karen from the farm. Hey, Karen.
Good morning, Elizabeth. Hi, Marjorie.
Nice to meet you, Karen. This is really exciting.
Nice I have meet you too.
A whole new appreciation for farmers. I've gotten to know some really wonderful ones out in Arizona. And when we talk about getting to know your farmer and why it's important, or at least getting to know where your food comes from, I think just from the get-go, when you meet somebody who has labored over what they're producing, boy, is it hard to waste their produce.
Yeah.
Right away, you have to have, I have such a greater appreciation now that I know the person who grew, you know, this citrus or who grew some of the other things that I buy at a farmer's market. And I love that. But what's happening on your farm right now, Karen?
Well, because it's spring, a lot is happening. So like if I were to give you sort of a what happened in the last 24 hours on the farm, it's a pretty long list.
Oh, I love that.
Everything from, you know, I mean, the orchard's in bloom, which is fantastic, right? So the bees are buzzing out there like crazy. We also keep bees. One of my sons and Sally do, and I try to help out when I'm willing to. It's not my favorite deal, but anyways, I love the honey, and I love all that I'm learning. They're a very complex system.
Oh, they're fascinating.
In and of themselves. So the orchard's in bloom. I was out picking asparagus this morning. Oh. You know, we brought some animals in for harvest yesterday, some sheep and pigs, and one of my sons helped me, and I swear if he would have had his camera and a video, it would have been a hysterical YouTube video, because sometimes these sheep are just wild and crazy and jump. And I mean, I'm trying to.
Sheep are nuts. Sheep are, they're like masochists, and they're smart, but they're dumb. They're like the dumbest smart animals.
Yes, they are. So, you know, they try to crash through things. So it's not an elegant process always, trailering animals. So we did that. And, you know, piglets came out to the backyard this morning because they're at that age where we have to set gates up so that we can deal with them in winter, which is the perfect height for a 2-week-old piglet to sneak under, you know. So they're out running around and the dogs are chasing them. And, you know, there's just sort of lots of sort of fun chaos this time of year. And then yesterday I was out doing fence repair in the pasture and
always
filling in these massive holes that we have out there when a badger popped his head out of one of those massive holes.
Oh my gosh.
To check out the country music I was listening to on the radio.
Oh,
and he literally was maybe 15 feet away from me at the most. And he kept popping his head out and going back down and popping his head out. And I was, first of all, irritated, like, okay. And maybe he knew I was filling something in on the other end, right? There was, but also sort of amazed and scared and terrified at the same time.
Just,
so you're managing predators. Both of my sons, they each raise batches of chickens. So we're dealing with sort of predator management with regards to those those animals on the farm right now, and securing them while giving them freedom, which is a big part of, and predators maybe not the only word you can use for, you know, for the rest of the animals that live on our farm, but they require management when you are giving freedom to animals. And so we've been dealing with the rest of the animals that we're not actually raising on purpose. We've been dealing with those a lot lately too. So, you know, there's a lot going on in spring.
And when did you grow up on a farm?
I did not grow up on a farm. I grew up in Roseville, which is just a small little inner loop suburb. And, but sort of took a circuitous route to farming, and have been taking it pretty seriously for the last 10 years, where we've been raising animals for meat production, and sort of had a farm that we evolved into a kind of a perennial type farm where we're not really growing anything that we just turn over year after year. So we don't grow annual vegetables. We right. don't bring in animals to finish. Everything is born here on the farm and then eventually finds an eater here directly from the farm.
It is just so cool. I mean, because when I first met you, Karen, you guys just had the pigs. I don't think right. there were even the sheep or the cow. And then you had chickens, of course, but those right. are a given. Those show right. up exactly. regardless.
Yeah, so, yeah, so we did. We started with pigs. And we love, they're still our favorites for sure. But we had this pasture, we turned everything from commodity crop into pasture. So then we needed to either to hay it or graze it. And the truth of the matter is when we started to hay it, the pocket covers, which took up residence because everything around us is in corn or soybeans. So there's no real habitat for them. They ended up coming to our farm. And so the folks that we would hire to hay would be like, Karen, that is such a bumpy ride. I'm not doing that anymore. Right. So we decided, well, we better get eaters instead, which made more sense anyways. It was kind of where we were headed to. So now we don't, now we graze our herd and then another herd or another part of a herd from friends down the street, and then they hay obviously other pasture, and so it's really been a nice relationship. So we graze cattle, and then we added the sheep because, of course, you know, once you have cattle grazing, you might as well have sheep.
So. You might as well have sheep, and that brings us so beautifully to the next part of the conversation, which is diversity on farms. Now, when Karen talks about this farm diversity and all of the different things that you have going on the farm, I mean, that is so rare when it comes to farms in the United States, the idea that you have all of those different animals and plants and things growing on the farm. But that is what makes your farm so alive. That's why everything's buzzing and everything's going on. So let's talk a little bit about that idea of diversity on farms, Karen, and why looking when you're even, I think, just deciding on a relationship with a farmer, why choosing one that is diverse is important.
Well, I would say there's several reasons why you would, as a small farmer, right? As we're talking if you're, you know, let's call it a 40-acre farm, or even if you're 20 acres, or even if you're 80 acres, potentially, that is of a size where you really can't just have a single crop and have that be a profitable enterprise. So, but at the same time, there's a reason that small diverse farms are declining. It's a lot of work.
Yes.
And it's a lot to manage and it's a lot to figure out. And there really is no formula for it. You just sort of have to learn and evolve and adjust and change. And so for us, we've sort of found a system where we've grown certain things at times to a size, scaled them, I should say, to a size that really wasn't a great fit. So to find the scale of everything has taken a lot of time. And now we're at a stage where we really haven't adjusted the scale too much in the last couple of years. So, you know, our orchard, for example, our pigs are in there in the fall. They clean up the apple drops, which is great. They all, you know, obviously the orchard itself helps with the bees. The ground cover in the orchard also is a pollinator-friendly environment. So that's kind of a symbiotic relationship. Our animals are outside year-round, but for the most part in winter, they hang out and they poop and pee indoors, right? And so we take that, which is in a bedding pack. It's in straw, mixed with straw, and that goes into a compost pile that we turn, and then eventually that compost gets used on the farm in the orchard setting and in various other places. And it's not a perfect system, don't get me wrong. There's definitely places where we wish we could manage things neater and tidier in terms of outputs and inputs, right? But for the most part, that diversity does two things. It mitigates some risk, right? Because some years the pest population of a certain thing is so high that it takes out everything that it favors. Raspberries, for example, you know, maybe, or Japanese beetles when they're really bad, they'll kill a certain crop, but they'll maybe leave blueberries alone. And so if you have enough diversity on your farm, you can withstand some of the environmental sort of hazards that we are seeing more and more often. And the same thing with the animals too, the diversity of animals. We can graze sheep and cattle together because they choose different feeds out there on the pasture. They don't always like the same things and one will clean up. You kind of graze sheep behind and they're less picky. Then you can run the pigs in there because they aren't picky at all. They just turn everything up. We have a litter of pigs in a wooded area that they, we use to clean up buckthorn and to keep the ground tilled up.
Oh my God.
As a matter of fact, they tilled up a garden for us the other day. Not, it wasn't really by design, but I'm like, you know what, this is where all garden will be now, you know? So, I mean, there's different ways that they work together, and sometimes they sort of fight each other, and we deal with all that was overkill on that situation. That was too much or too little, but we've sort of struck a balance, but it's taken a long time to get there.
I just love listening to you talk about it, because I think the hot word in sustainability is circular economies. And I think all we have to do is go back and look at a small farm to see the definition of a circular economy. And I think there are so many lessons to learn from, I think, the mindfulness that you have to have in order to run a small farm. Now, Karen, this is your livelihood, correct? I mean, this isn't this isn't a farm. It's not a hobby farm.
We farm for profit, but, you know, we're like most farms, or we're like every farm, small farm that I know, where off-farm income is really what sustains your family.
Yeah.
You certainly approach every year as though profit on the farm is a requirement, right? It's because of all the work that goes into it. And it's not easy to do. It's a challenging equation. And it's challenging in a time like this. It's sort of interesting. Obviously, farms like ours that produce meat, it's in very high demand. And, you know, people are sort of coming out of the woodwork, which is, on the one hand, it's just an awesome thing to sort of have people who have been driving by for years and will stop in and go, I've been driving by for years. And it just never, either A, they don't have time, right? It's just not on their convenience measure to stop in when they're on their way home, when they've already done grocery shopping or somewhere else to buy one item or two items, right? But at the same time, to try to pivot to support that is really difficult. So you can't just sort of magically snap your finger and say, okay, we'll produce five times the amount of meat that we were a year ago, you know? But we can't really support any more than we already do. But at the same time, we want so much for people to sort of have an aha moment to sort of say, you know, these things, we value these things in our lives. And while we sort of, you know, we take it a lot for granted in most of the time, when you do sit down and you think about how you want to look at food as something that's sustaining you, maybe having a little more transparent source, maybe something you value, maybe having a source that is, if you're an animal lover and a meat eater, maybe you want to think about, okay, how do I want to balance that out in my life? If you're a vegetarian, but not a vegan, and you eat eggs, do you want to think about what happens to the hen after it's produced the eggs, and maybe source stew hens? As, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can approach depending on what your particular priorities are. But at the end of the day, if you try to just move a little bit towards seasonal and more transparent food sources, you will end up gravitating to something that's local.
Yeah, it's so true, Karen. It is so true. And that really helps to break it down for people. And I've talked about this before. I was vegetarian for 4 years when I was in my early 20s. And it's because I read the book Diet for a New America, which will turn anyone vegetarian, by the way. So be careful if you decide to read it. But it is... what the book does is it outlines the conditions of factory farming, and it is quite troubling. And so at the time when I read that book, and I'm an animal lover and a meat eater, and at the time when I read that book, I couldn't afford and didn't have access to meat that I felt was possible to have raised in the way that I thought it should be raised. And so I just quit eating meat altogether. And then as things kind of progressed and I was able to move different places and find connections with different people, and then also not be living off of like $8 an hour, then things improved and I was able to like start to afford that. And so I started eating meat again. But my philosophy has always been that animals were created to live a certain way, right? I mean, when you see a pig, you know how a pig wants to live, right? It's not a pet. And they want to snuffle in the ground. They want to go through and get everything. They want to roll around outside. They want to raise their young. I mean, these are all things that these animals were created to do. And so my meat philosophy and egg philosophy and basically all animal product philosophy has been to purchase products that are raised in the way that these animals were designed to live. So like when I look at my chickens in the backyard, you know, I got three of them, Karen. It's a real big deal. And
yes, I know.
they live like chickens want to live. We protect them, but then like they're outside in the yard right now, eating the tips of grass and pecking around and finding all sorts of bugs and slugs and whatever. And the truth of the matter is that most meat and eggs that are raised in this country and milk, these animals are not living like the animals were intended to live. That's my fundamental belief. And that's a hard thing, because when you see a farm like Karen's and you see like the piglets out and about and the piglets nursing from the mama and the, you know, all these things happening, that's not happening in a lot of places.
Well, and I think when you talk about that, Elizabeth, if you just take it to the consumer side, your eggs taste better.
That's true.
Things taste better when the animals that are producing it for us are living under the conditions. I believe this in my heart, when they're living under conditions that are more natural and more akin to what it would have been 100 years ago. I've told Elizabeth about this, but Karen, I interviewed a dairy goat farmer, and he makes some of the best goat cheese in the valley. And his whole philosophy is the cheese tastes good because the goats are happy. It's happy cheese. And I 100% agree with him. I think it can't be in order to feed the amount of people that we need to feed. But I think we have to keep getting close back to it as close as we can. And I think for those of us that have the means to, or have the transportation to, or can get closer to our farmers, I think it's kind of our duty to do it.
That's one of the things I often struggle with in talking to folks about what we do, because I mm-hmm. don't want to judge folks, people who make other decisions, right?
Yeah.
The price point, even though we've eliminated a distributor and a retailer and a whatever from the equation, our price point is not the same, right? I mean, one of the things I always tell folks is just eat less meat. I mean, truly, we raise meat, right? But if we all ate less of it, that would be a good place to start, right? And then choose, at least incrementally, again, choose some place where you sort of say, all right, I'm going to sort of draw the line here. And I always make the pitch for pigs, because generally speaking, in any large type of production setting, the animal that has an experience that is the farthest from what they should be living, it would be pigs, right? Mm-hmm. Pigs are very smart. I posted something on my Facebook page the other day about the things that are different and the same between our dogs and the pigs. And and really, when you put the list together, you'd like, all right, we love our dogs, but man, I'm just the pigs. They've got quite a few qualities that are actually, you know, with the exception of course, is that they grow. They have a stomach that is much larger than, you know, than you would sort of want to maintain. They're harder to maintain their size, right? So, but pigs in general are the ones that we've created such a commodity approach to that animal that it's really borders on unacceptable, inhumane, in a way that I'm uncomfortable supporting.
Yeah.
Right. Even though that's the one thing I do judge, and I don't judge the farmers necessarily, because they did not start out thinking, oh, I want to raise these animals in this way. But there's a necessity that goes with scale. There's a necessity that comes with giving, if you give freedom to an animal and what you have to do to manage that is extremely labor and land intensive, right? Mm-hmm, so but they live from birth to death in a really difficult environment.
Yeah.
Where really beef cattle, sheep, chickens, although chickens, I'll set that aside.
Yeah, chickens get dicey.
But for a lot of their life, they are pasture grazed. They are outside. They end up in a feedlot, which is not a great experience. And then things have to be done to support them being able to tolerate that. But pigs are the one where I would say, if you're going to make any little step forward in the sort of humane animal welfare focused approach to meat eating, I would start with pigs and then follow that with chickens. and the thing about chickens is we're so used to these chickens that are hybridized. And again, I would even take it one step further and I would say, don't buy a hybridized animal, one that's been improved to be a widget, right? One that's been improved to be able to fit into a system that is efficient and cheap and gains and is identical to every other one in mass, which is what has to be done in order to produce a factory farm. So find heritage breeds so that we can keep the diversity, that biological diversity that is so important in the animal kingdom. Just like it's important to have heirloom tomatoes and heirloom seed, it's important to have heirloom animals that have not been improved, quote unquote, right, in order to fit into these large systems. Because as soon as you lose that, you can't really get that back.
Yeah. Mm.
The animals that we raise in meat production, large scale meat production, can't really live in the way our pigs live anymore. All of those skills have been bred out of them. And so I would just sort of say, you know, even to take one small step here and there to look for and try to support in an animal that is heritage and breed or unimproved, so to speak, that isn't hybridized, which means it's not going to be grown in a large scale setting, and just eat a little bit of that while you're eating a little less of the other kind.
It's such a good philosophy, and it is so smart, and it helps people, I think, Karen, so much to have that starting point, because I do think the step that I took in my early 20s, which was to just not eat it at all, I didn't feel great about that either, but I didn't know what else to do. And I felt so overwhelmed and
sad. Well, you're at an age now, Elizabeth, where when you were doing that, there were no other options.
I know. Wasn't. I mean, I was living in Duluth. I couldn't get anything.
You can go to Chipotle and feel pretty good about having a carnitas. I mean,
I know.
It's not perfect, but the farms and the way they raise those animals are so many steps above, right? They're not all the way to where you'd want to be necessarily, but you can't. I mean, there's certainly a situation there where you have to make some trade-offs. You can buy Applegate and feel pretty good about that. Mm-hmm. You know.
And I think we have to get to the point, too, for when we're talking about mass consumption, of acknowledging that better is better. That if like when you say you can go to Chipotle, that's going to surprise a lot of people. That's one of the reasons I do go to Chipotle, is I know that they do that with some intention. But I think that'll surprise people that would be on like a good list of they're trying. I think there are lots of places where you can go, where you can ask questions about where the meat's coming from and all of those things. But just from a consumer side again, which is, I think, what we're in the big picture, what we're talking about when we're talking about our own nests. When you talk about those heritage breeds, I think the one thing people may not be thinking about, I think more people are thinking about this, but I would just say, when you buy really good meat, it's going to be more expensive, yes, but it will taste better. So eat less of it.
Right.
And put more vegetables on your plate.
Exactly.
It's true. It is.
That you should really be thinking about when we think about our nests and how we cook and what we're eating and what we're feeding our families. That's a big deal. If you're going to pay more, somebody, I won't out her, but I was talking to somebody and they're like, hey, we've got this chicken, this roasted chicken for $4. And it was everything I could do to just not make that a moment of judgment.
Yeah.
It's a $4 chicken and it's going to taste like a $4 chicken.
It's so funny. When I was growing up, my mom always made Southern fried chicken for us because she's from Texas and we love it. And she says, she has this saying, and she gets real Southern when she says it. And she says, I can smell cheap chicken a mile away. I can smell cheap chicken a mile away. Because I remember she wouldn't get chicken from the grocery store when we were kids. She would go to like the specialty butcher shop that was in town and go and buy chickens there when we would have chicken. And she would always say that. And I remember that being like a fundamental. And certainly we had Lucky Charms in the cabinet at all times, guys. It was not perfection in the Reese house, let me tell you. But that being said, when it came to a cheap chicken, I remember that message very early on connecting with me that there is something about where you put your dollars. Okay. Right. And I also want to talk.
There's one other thing I want to just add to that real quick.
Yeah.
Is that there is some ways to help solve that a little bit. And one of the ways is to buy cheaper cuts of meat from higher quality animals. And I get requests all the time for, okay, how do I use this skirt steak, or how do I use this flank steak, or how do I use this flat iron steak, and how do you cook it, right? Because they're cheaper, tougher, slow cook cuts.
Right.
Or the shanks, braised shank of anything is fantastic. And so you can find ways to sort of lower some of that price point a little bit by buying not your tenderloin or your pork loins or your expensive
right.
cuts, but by those slower, cheaper cuts of meat, and then cook them you can Google all kinds of great cooking options. It's very easy to do. And so that I've been doing that a lot with folks, because I always say, if you're going to buy this from me, you're also going to have to buy this from me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're going to buy the high end cut, you also are going to have to try these cuts.
Oh, I
because
love that.
We don't want to waste. We don't want to have a freezer full at the end of the month or whatever
yeah,
it is,
right.
full of just like I said, like flat iron steaks. People go, huh? What do I do with that? Right. So I kind of force that on people to say, you know what? Give it a try, and here's how you cook it. And usually they'll send a text and they go, that was fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So that's one
great.
Way to kind of help mitigate a little bit of that cost, and it's not going to solve all of it, but it does help a little bit.
Listen, that's like chicken thighs are way cheaper than chicken breasts.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to buy like a pieced up chicken, chicken thighs are so, and they're so much better, guys.
Yes.
It's like the best thing. It's the secret. Whenever I make chicken thighs, my children are like, oh, I love this chicken. I love this chicken. They love it. So I want to talk to Karen about that idea also of, we bring everything back to our own homes on this podcast. It's all about trying to create this healthy, strong home so that when you leave the nest, you can be your best. And I really think what we've been talking so much about on this podcast is everything that you bring into your home means something and has a story and has something to it. And I think there is a shift when you are bringing food in that is high quality and good, and you're connected to the growers. It's like a different feeling when you get home from the farmer's market with your bag of stuff than when you get home from just kind of whatever generic store. And I'm sure you have to find that from people, Karen. They connect with you and they want to come back.
Absolutely. And I mean, we have that same experience ourselves, right? When we get to a certain part of the year where we're making a meal that's completely from the farm, it's really hard to beat. And so even we as farmers have that experience. And it's like we were talking earlier about the first sip of coffee of the day. That's like the best one, right? The first ear of sweet corn. But you don't want to buy that sweet. I won't eat sweet corn if it's not Minnesota grown right down the street. Sweet corn, right? That was harvested like within 2 hours, because that's the best. And so trying to eat more seasonally and locally, just that alone will improve the quality of your food. When I can tomatoes, if I'm canning heirloom tomatoes, those jars, I won't let anybody touch those, on the shelf. Because in preserving, I mean, that's the next step, right? If you want to take that and say, well, that first bite of corn doesn't do me any good a month later, right? Well, preserve it. It preserves, that flavor stays. So we do a lot of canning and freezing, and I encourage people to do that all the time. When something is in season, buy it and preserve it. And you will actually know the difference. It does taste better even under those circumstances, and which there's nothing better than having a pomodoro, angel hair with heirloom tomato sauce in February, it's just the best. So
it's so true.
Buying seasonally, buying locally, and then preserving, learning to preserve it is it's kind of a homesteading philosophy, but it really does. And again, when I walk in the back door, which we have a kind of a pantry wall, when we come in our mudroom and I look up on the shelves and there it's full of jams and honey and canned goods and pickles and tomatoes, it's just the best feeling. It's like, okay, in a zombie apocalypse, we've got canned chicken and tomatoes.
No kidding. Or a global pandemic. It's totally
pandemic.
True. And I think,
we don't even have to search too far to say zombie apocalypse.
Exactly.
And that's what people are searching for, that sense of security. And you can do that in Karen's fashion, which is so beautiful to have this gorgeous farm. And at our former house was 0.13 of an acre. And I spent the 2 days before Franklin was born pulling 5 pounds of cherries. cherries off my cherry tree in the front yard and making jam. I mean, so the point is that it can be done out in the country. And I had my own little version of that, mini version, very mini version of that on that small of a piece of land. But that food security, I am just convinced, and I've been on this path for about a decade in my own life, but that a freezer full of meat where I knew where it came from, things that are preserved from my own garden, growing things in my own garden, having a relationship with people that I know that I can send a text to and go, hey, can I buy this from you directly? It is like a sense of security that you have that then when the bleep hits the fan, like right now, you don't have that fear of I'm not going to be able to feed my family. And fear is not good. And security is good.
Right. And I think, too, I mean, I always feel like we have to circle back again to sort of the a lot of the consumers out there that are living and before the pandemic, we're living with financial fears and financial insecurity. I remember thinking when my kids were little, because when my husband and I first got married, we were so, so broke. And by the time we had kids, we were doing a little bit better. And going to the grocery store, I knew what it felt like to go to the grocery store when I didn't have much money. And it was very stressful. And luckily, it was just the two of us. And so, you know, I'd clip coupons and whatever. And I remember thinking when I had kids, I had this deep sense of gratitude that I could get what I needed, that I could choose organic milk, that I could choose the best eggs, because I knew that, to me, that mattered for them. That's what I wanted for them. And I didn't have a lot of stress at the grocery store. But I remember very clearly what that stress felt like. And so I think when we're talking about these things, when we talk about knowing where your food comes from and all of that, people immediately, as we've talk about price point and expense. And I would just stress to people, if you're listening and you've got young kids and things are hard right now or financially it's hard, do check out your farmer's market. Because what I loved is when I went and did a story on one of the farmer's markets in Phoenix, they had this whole program that if you were on, you had subsidized coupons, you know.
Like WIC or something.
Yeah, if you had that, they had a program where you would turn that in and they would give you these like chips and it doubled your money. So if you were spending it on vegetables, you would use those that $10 or that $20 that you receive from the government and it would be worth $40 in vegetables or $40 in the produce that was at the market.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important when people think about this, especially if you've lost your job or anything, if you're under financial stress, look around for the programs, because a lot of communities now, a lot of governments, small city governments are acutely aware of the connection of the farmers markets to their own towns. And they're trying to come up with programs to make that food be affordable and easy to purchase. So just I think it's worth knowing that you can go out there and try and see if there's a program like that in your neighborhood. Because I was stunned when the woman who ran the farmers market was telling me about it. I was like, this is the best thing ever, because it's good for the farmers and it's good for the people that want to feed their kids good, healthy food. So I think that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, there's certainly avenues and resources out there. Let's talk about, Karen, before we go, life on the farm, because, again, you know, and I always do this with you because I think your farm is so beautiful and it's like you just think it's magical. And Karen and Sally and the boys are floating around everywhere and they're flitting and flatting around and they're just leaping for joy and they're just stopping to smell flowers all the time. But that raising your family on a farm is an experience that like your kids are going to grow up and go, I grew up on a farm. And that's a very cool and it will be a unique thing. What are some of the things that you're seeing that are benefits to your family from living this way, right? Even though I know it's so much work.
Well, yeah, like you have this fantastic podcast. If I did a podcast, it would probably be called something like, So You Want to Be a Farmer, right?
That's a good podcast name.
Yeah, right? I'd listen.
Yeah, exactly. And when I think about the kids, I think about this all the time. I think, are they going to look at the farm when they're older and think of it like, you know how we have these memories of a vacation that really are through rose-colored glasses, right?
Yeah, right?
Is that how they're going to think of the farm? Like it was this fabulous thing? Or are they going to think, oh my God, my mom's worked so hard. That's nuts. I know. You know,
what were they doing? Why did they do that? You know? Yeah.
And I always have had this idea that as I'm doing these chores and building these things out, that when the kids are of an age where they really can take on a lot of it, I'll be at the age where I'll be able to back off. I'm aging faster than they are, clearly. And my sort of time frame is like still 3 years out. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not sure if I can manage it. But they are taking on more and more, in part because they're home. And so one of massive silver linings of this COVID-19 situation has been them being home, coming out during their lunch break and saying, hey, mama, what are you doing? You know, checking on their chickens, finding me, coming out to the pasture to find me, exploring the farm in ways that they never have before. Oh. And it hasn't turned them off to it, which I think is a good thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so I know that the experience that they're having will matter to them in ways that they don't resonate with them always now.
Right.
When they think now, when we talk about it, almost as kind of a trick, what if we sold the farm, guys, right? They go, huh? What? Huh? You know, well, at the same time, they would love to live in a neighborhood where they had friends right across the street. Right. And so, you know, there's a tricky balance there to sort of the country living distant from neighbors, trying to create a community that I think they now see exists. It's just not in our face. Right. The community that we've developed here on the farm with other farmers, with local folks here that appreciate what we do is significant and important in ways that they don't see as often, but in ways that really they feel a strong sense of, aha, like, okay, this is important. And we don't know why we value this, but we do. You know, you can tell that they do. They love it if a customer comes to say, hey, mom, a customer's here, you know?
Yeah.
And so they are certainly learning about the hard stuff as well as the joys. You know, there's a lot of hardships and a lot of hard things happening on a farm when you raise livestock. And they've experienced that themselves, again, with having responsibility for the last few years of chickens that they raise batches of and having to care for them and losing some of them and how that is real. And so, you know, that's a pretty small scale kind of thing, but they see a lot of what goes on and recognize that that experience is unique and is special and it's not perfect and it's not all just fantastic, but it's one I don't think they would want to trade in for anything. So, you know, we feel good about that. You know?
Well, and that gift, I mean, that gift that you give to them, and I think you can, you certainly don't have to live on a farm. It helps if you live on a farm, but the gift of giving your children the connection to their food is an unbelievable gift. And that is something that we're working on all the time with our kids. And I just feel that it's so important because I think it helps them understand their place in the world, understand their responsibility in the world. It allows them to have a positive relationship with food, which so many people don't have. And it allows them to see. That's fair. That's fair. If you're not an asparagus fan, you can make that call. Yep. You can totally make that call. But that gift is incredible. And Karen, you know, I sing your praises. So I'm just so happy that you were able to join us today and talk to us about this. And Marjorie, too, I'm going to post on our social media a story I did at Karen's farm 4 years ago.
Oh, good.
Where I commented that I looked much younger. And you guys can watch that, too, so that you can get a visual of the farm that we're talking about.
And Karen, I also think, you know, after my big strawberry tragedy, I also think the lessons they're learning are about hardship. And I think the sense of I really can't imagine what it would be like to lose all the raspberries.
Right.
I lost one strawberry and I was very upset about that.
Right.
So I think there's something about losing, of learning how to deal and overcome all the time, which I think is probably a part of farming, is that cycle of loss and gain.
It's if it were more gain than loss, more people would do it. Not that many people do it, because really that's the reality is sort of the reverse. There's more of the other stuff that goes along with it. And even if you are the best farmer in the world, which I am not, you have a lot of things that you have to sort of overcome and be resourceful and figure out and learn from. And if they understand exactly the progression of a piglet to a bacon, right?
Right.
All of it. And so they value that. And I think if we all had an understanding of sort of that birth to death aspect of meat, and even the birth to death aspect in or ingesting of a marshmallow, right? We'd eat less of both, right? You know, we'd eat less of both of those things. If we understood all of the processed food and exactly where that comes from and what that's done, what that does to you, and the same thing with meat, if we're animal lovers, right? And so just understanding a little bit more of how food is produced and what the trade-offs are, and having more transparency in the system in general so that people can make their choices. That's what I always try to advocate for. It's just more transparency and knowledge so that people can make informed choices. And then they can use their resources to enhance their life in ways that are more meaningful than just kind of the everything for convenience sake. Cause it's an easy trap to get into, you know, even we do it, you know?
Yeah. Yep. It is. Thanks, love Karen. That. Oh, love you. Thank you so much. I'll send you back my cut sheet. I got it. So I'm all set to go. And I'll probably have questions because I'm always like, wait, what do I like again? How do I want this done? What's the thickness of the pork chops? It's so good.
Thanks,
Karen. Take care. And
thank you.
We will also post that you can connect with Karen on Littlefoot Farms Facebook page, which is where they're posting all sorts of great stuff, and find out how you can get your hands on some Littlefoot meat and find your local farmer. It's good stuff.
Sounds great. Thanks, gals.
If you are enjoying this podcast, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a review at Apple Podcasts. From Pape 04. She says, the college episode, Elizabeth. Thank you. As a mom of a senior, I am having those emotions every day, and it is uncharted territory. And so just hearing how I am feeling, I feel normal.
Oh, we are so glad. That's great. Hey, we want to mention, too, that we have a special, exciting thing to share with you. If you want to get in on an exclusive Best to the Nest Zoom happy hour, Marjorie, you can. OK, so here's what we're doing. You can win a chance to chat with us on Zoom. We're going to do our very first Zoom happy hour, and it's going to take place on Thursday, June 11th from 5 to 6 p.m. So 20 winners will be invited to join an hour long Zoom meeting room chat with us and listeners. And then we can talk about anything that's on your mind, ask questions, discuss bringing your best to the nest. So here's what you need to do. You need to get the PodMN app. Okay. So Marjorie, this is a really cool app, and Best to the Nest is on it, and it's Minnesota based podcasts. So if you're interested in other local podcasts too, it's a great opportunity to take a look at what's being produced in our great state. It's available in the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. You listen to 30 minutes of Best to the Nest in a day on the PodMN app, and then you earn a chance to win. So when you listen for at least 30 minutes in a day, you'll get one entry towards the prize. Isn't this fun?
I know. I can't wait to see people. I just think that'll be so much fun to see the little Best to the Nest community and just hang out. And you all might have questions for us, but I've got questions for all of you. So
I know.
Please join us. I think it'll be really fun. I'm hoping and I'm guessing we're going to record this, and I would love to turn that into a Best to the Nest episode.
Wouldn't that be so fun?
Yeah, so other people can hear the community that's out there.
I just love that idea. So the contest ends May 31st, 2020 at 11:45 p.m. So get that PodMN app, again, available in the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. Listen to 30 minutes daily of the Best to the Nest podcast, and you will be entered. And then the team there at PodMN will let you know if you've been selected. So we're so looking forward to that. Also, find us on Facebook and Instagram at Best to the Nest, or go to besttothenest.com to subscribe to our newsletter. We are the podcast that brings you home.